You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Since the end of the military phase of the war on Iraq, debate over the U.S.'s self-appointed right and responsibility to preempt perceived global security threats has shifted its focus away from Baghdad. Now many of the same figures in Congress, the Pentagon, and the White House, who most strongly advocated for the war on Iraq, are now pressing hard for preemptive strikes on Iran. In addition to what they call a dangerous and deeply anti-American Islamic ruling class, the advocates of preemptive action cite supposed evidence of a budding nuclear weapons program and close political ties with al-Qaeda. Speaking today in Tehran, Iran's supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, dismissed these threats and warned the U.S. that an attack on his country would be suicidal. Reese Ehrlich, veteran foreign correspondent and producer of the public radio special, The Struggle for Iran, feels that many of these allegations are unfounded and are part of a design to promote a far less noble agenda in the Middle East at large.
That's the biggest lie that they're promoting. Remember, the Bush administration claimed that Iraq had ties with al-Qaeda as well, and it turned out to be a complete myth. If you know anything about the history of Iran and its revolution and al-Qaeda, they are on opposite sides politically. The Afghan government under the Taliban killed a number of Iranian diplomats when they invaded an Iranian diplomatic compound in Afghanistan. The Iranians were actively supporting guerrilla groups against the Taliban and their allies, al-Qaeda. So they are on opposite sides of the fence politically, although that's not widely known here. So to me, it's inconceivable that the Iranian government's official policy is to support al-Qaeda. Are there individual al-Qaeda people who may have escaped from Afghanistan into Iran and they've got a very large border? Sure, that's possible. But I don't think the Iranian government is supporting them, just like it made no sense for Iraq to support al-Qaeda. So you think of the old days under the Cold War era, everybody was a communist. Mm. If you were a communist, if you were a nationalist, if you were a Democrat, anybody who opposed the United States suddenly got labeled a communist. Well, the U.S. is doing the exact same thing now with terrorists. It doesn't matter whether these are people with completely opposite political views who hate each other, who shoot each other. If you're a terrorist and you're labeled by the U.S., you must be all ganging up on the U.S.
And you're part of the axis of evil, quote unquote.
Yep.
What about Iran's nuclear capabilities?
Well, like I said, I don't think anybody really knows whether they've got nuclear capabilities or not. First, I would note the U.S. engages in massive hypocrisy about concern about nuclear capabilities. Everybody knows that Israel has 200-plus nuclear bombs, and I have not heard one peep out of the United States ever under Democratic or Republican administrations calling for the end to Israel's weapons of mass destruction. Where are the calls for inspectors to go in to force the Israelis to dismantle their nuclear weapons? Never. Nowhere. Where's the calls to Pakistan to get rid of its nuclear weapons? I mean, if you're pro-U.S., well, and you've got nuclear weapons, we'll just give you a wink and a nod, and that's okay. I don't think nuclear proliferation is a good idea. I don't think countries should have nuclear weapons. But as I mentioned before, there are means internationally through the International Atomic Energy Commission based in Vienna to verify whether a country is developing nuclear weapons through reasonable international inspectors checking it out. If the U.S. is serious about that, they should follow the protocols and let international commissions verify whether this is an accurate charge or not.
And finally, Iran's leader, Mohammad Khatami, what can you tell us about him?
Well, the Iranian leadership is split. The president is a reformer who has introduced positive democratic changes. He's supported by the parliament. Every time the Iranians have a free election, they elect more reformers. The religious leaders, the mullahs, however, under the constitution and through intimidation and force, exercise the dominant control. They will not allow certain people to run for office. They can void elections. They close newspapers. They send provocateurs or police in to bust up peaceful demonstrations. It's a very repressive country, but there's also a very vibrant movement for democratic change. That is represented by the president. So that's been an ongoing struggle for some time. At one time, the Clinton administration made some openings to Iran in hopes of encouraging the more democratic forces and getting an in. Apparently, the Bush administration decided that they're going to shut the door on that. But it doesn't change the situation on the ground. If there's going to be change in Iran, it's got to come from within, from the people of Iran themselves, not being imposed from the outside by the United States. We can see what a disaster that is in Iraq.
Mm-hmm. And who would you say has really ultimately the most sway over the nation?
I would say at the moment the conservative mullahs and their hierarchy have the dominant power.
Hmm. Any final thoughts on your part, Reese Ehrlich?
Well, I think some people, since the end of the active fighting in Iraq, have become a bit discouraged or feeling what they had done to oppose the war was useless. And I think people should understand that the anti-war movement had a tremendous impact worldwide. The fact that there were so many people out in the streets demonstrating stiffened the resistance of the French and the Russians and therefore forced the United States to act without the UN sanctions. The government of Turkey was responding to the strong sentiment and the peace movement within its own country, and it banned the U.S. Use of its bases. And now the fact that so few countries have contributed money or troops is making it much more difficult for the U.S. to occupy Iraq. So the anti-war forces, while not able to stop the invasion, had a tremendous impact, and even to this day are having a tremendous impact. And that it's important to take a long-term view that opposing Bush's policies can and will do some good, and I think we're going to see that going into next year.
Reese Ehrlich, veteran foreign correspondent and producer of the public radio special, The Struggle for Iran. As Iraq attempts to make the arduous transition from an oppressive dictatorship to a democratic and representative government, the U.S. military occupation and interim leadership look as though they will continue indefinitely. But we're reminded that this is by no means the first time the United States has tried its hand at nation building in the Middle East with a stated goal of promoting stability in the region. 2003 marks the 50th anniversary of the installation of the Shah of Iran by U.S. forces. Former U.S. Attorney General Ramsey Clark delivered an address in which he described his unforgettable meeting with the exiled Iranian fundamentalist leader, Ayatollah Khomeini. The words of these two men give a historical and personal perspective on the U.S.'s Machiavellian relationship with Iran and Iraq over the past five decades.
This recollection is from about 21 years ago. It was winter and cold and rainy, and we'd flown into Paris to meet with the man that the world knows is Ayatollah Khomeini. He had been given sanctuary in Iraq for many years, finally felt that he had to leave. France offered him asylum. He had never seen a train or an automobile for the first 55 years of his life. He felt that industrialization was a threat to his religion, to humanity, to life. He lived in a country where the aspiration of the Shah, promoted by the United States, was to make Iran the fifth great industrial nation of the world. So there's this enormous tension. He finally came in, and a large, strikingly handsome man with piercing gray eyes, and got right to the point. He wanted to talk, and he said, "I'm glad to meet you. I've got a few questions I want to ask." And his first question was, "Does President Carter, this was during the Carter administration, really believe in human rights, in your opinion? And if so, why does he condone the treatment of the Iranian people as it is by the Shah? And why did he say on the first New Year's Eve of his first year as president, in a toast in Tehran, not a mile from Khosra prison, where you could almost hear the moans and screams of tortured prisoners, why did he say in this toast, your president, Carter, to the Shah of Iran, that we share your commitment to human rights?" That year, it's now estimated that 43,000 people were summarily murdered or executed in Iran. You don't need to hear my answer. The next question was, are the American people really free, as you say they are? And if they are, why do they permit their government to do the things it does? And he gave a few unhappy illustrations. Now, as I talk about our conduct in this one little epoch toward Iraq, I'll point out first that it is directly and painfully related to our history with Iran. For 25 years, Iran was the U.S. surrogate in this region. From the day in 1953 when what we proudly called the moment we restored the Shah to his throne, he was in his early 20s, why we had such affinity for the peacock throne that we never had for King George III is another question. But that's what we claimed to do, and in fact that's what we did. And the consequence, not just for the people of Iran for the next 25 years, that's a fourth of a century, was stunning brutality and violence and degradation, culturicide and homicide, and for many, genocide. Many, by that I mean sects and groups. Iran's a very diverse country, not 60% are Farsi-speaking people there. The Iran-Iraq war was a direct consequence, without question, of that 25 years of misery in which we urged, without question, Iraq, and in which more than 1 million very young men lost their lives. And at the beginning of which, our preeminent foreign policy advisor, Henry Kissinger, said, "I hope they kill each other." There's a humanitarian thought. I hope they kill each other. So 1 million young men go out to die. And we backed Iraq to the hilt. For 25 years, we had provided the Shah with anything he wanted in the way of military equipment, training, aid of any kind. We ought to have. He spent tens of billions of dollars. Between 1972 and 1976, $22 billion in arms sold by the United States to Iran. 3 weapon systems we were able to finance because of Iranian purchases. We wouldn't have done it otherwise. And William Colby, who had been with the CIA most of those 25 years and director at the end of the period, about 3 years later wrote, "The proudest achievement of the CIA is the restoration of the Shah to the throne of Iran, because it gave us dominance of that vital region for 25 years. When we lost that, we had to replace it, because our geopolitical judgment was that whoever controlled that crossroads between Northeast Africa and Southwest Asia, the Middle East and Europe, and 60% at least of the oil resources of the world would be in the dominant worldwide trade position for the next 40 to 50 years. And we intended to be that power."
Ramsey Clark, U.S. Attorney General in the Lyndon Johnson administration. He spoke at the Generation Action Gathering hosted by the Bruderhof religious community in upstate New York. Today was the final day of a major teach-in in Congress by Tikkun, a progressive Jewish organization, to make recommendations for a peaceful settlement of issues between the State of Israel and the State of Palestine. Peace Watch spoke with Chair Rabbi Lerner last Friday regarding the war in Iraq and the consequences affecting other states in the Middle East. Today, in part two of that conversation, we asked Lerner how influential he felt Israel was in shaping U.S. foreign policy.
Well, I think I don't want to overestimate that, because there's no question in my mind that if George Bush had decided that it was more in the interest of the United States to be involved in a war with, let's say, North Korea than with Iraq, that's what would have happened. And so although it's certainly true that the AIPAC kinds of people supported and favored and pushed for an invasion of Iraq, it's also the case that they weren't really the decisive force in that, and they won't be the decisive force with regard to Iran or Syria either. The United States is controlled by an elite of wealth and power that is very successful in part because it's able to get its agenda to be accepted by the vast majority of Americans in a democratic process. A democratic process, of course, as we know, manipulated by a media controlled by large corporations and elections that are disproportionately impacted on by the wealthy, mm-hmm. and in which ordinary citizens have a very slight chance of getting their worldviews or their perspectives heard. In my view, and in the view of the Tikkun community, this is the thing that is really in Israel's interest is peace and reconciliation with the Palestinian people. Mm-hmm. And these people, who claim to be pro-Israel, in my view, are not pro-Israel. They're pro-Ariel Sharon, and they're pro a very narrow perspective on what is in Israel's interest. And in my view, very destructive. I think that these the AIPAC people, they represent the worst interests of the Jewish people. They're actually objectively destructive to the best interests of the Jewish people.
Israeli Defense Minister Shaul Mofaz indicated in an interview last month with the Tel Aviv newspaper Ma'ariv that Israel was lobbying the U.S. to take military action against Syria. And several weeks ago, the Jewish newspaper The Forward reported that a coalition of Jewish groups, conservative hawks and Iranian monarchs, is urging the U.S. to bring about regime change in Iran. Morris Adamay, a former director of AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, told the paper that it would only be natural for Jewish groups to openly back regime change in Iran. Do you agree with that?
Well, it's natural for the reactionary elements in the Jewish world, but the whole point of the Tikkun community is that there are a lot of other kinds of people in the Jewish world. And the Tikkun community is made up of the progressives in the Jewish world, plus we're also progressives in Christian, Islamic, Hindu, Buddhist, and many, many secular humanists, mm-hmm. including Cornel West, the African-American, who is the co-chair with me of the Tikkun community. And we represent a whole different kind of voice than the voice of the more conservative elements in the organized Jewish community. And there in our organization, many, many progressive Jews who strongly disagree with that as being in the interest of the Jewish people.
Rabbi Michael Lerner, and so finally, your organization, Tikkun, was in battle and controversy back in February when you were not invited or uninvited to speak at a giant anti-war rally in San Francisco. You say you were prohibited because of your criticism of what you referred to as anti-Israel propaganda being distributed by the activist group Act Now to Stop War and End Racism at a previous rally, and yet rally organizers, meanwhile, say that they had the option of inviting whoever they wanted and that it wasn't a political issue since other rabbis were invited. But regardless, the San Jose Mercury News reported the situation highlighted deep tensions within the peace movement over how to address the Israeli-Palestinian conflict while building broad opposition to the U.S. war with Iraq. Now, Rabbi, your organization takes a really unique stance on this issue, such that you've at times been hated by both the left and you've been called a self-hating Jew and received bomb threats from the far right. Can you explain for our listeners what exactly the Tikkun community believes is the way to go about diffusing tensions?
In Washington, this week, we're bringing people from all over the country to create an alternative to AIPAC, and a progressive alternative to AIPAC that is both pro-Israel and pro-Palestine. And the reason that that's possible is because we believe that the best interests of Israel will be served by the creation of a strong and viable Palestinian state, just as we believe the best interests of the Palestinian people will be achieved when Israelis feel secure and not constantly threatened with acts of terror in their own society. So we're creating an alternative to AIPAC, and that alternative to AIPAC calls for a progressive middle path that recognizes that the fate of these two peoples is intrinsically connected and that both peoples have co-created the mess in the Middle East, that both peoples have a legitimate story to tell and a legitimate set of claims, and that both peoples have acted in cruel and hurtful ways to the other and need to repent for it. Both the Jews need to repent for what they've done to Palestinians, and Palestinians need to repent for what they did, what they've been doing to Israel. So we're creating a progressive middle path that is calling for an end to the occupation, reparations for the Palestinian people, security for Israel, security for a strong Palestinian state, and a cooperation between these two peoples, mm-hmm. and a Truth and Reconciliation Commission modeled on the form of South Africa that would begin the process of healing between the two peoples. And this is a vision that is very different from that being put forward by the roadmap. Mm-hmm. Because the roadmap that President Bush has put forward has it backwards. He has the last, he is telling people that for 3 years they should go through various steps, and at the end of those steps, then they should have a negotiation about what will be the outcome. If you want that to work, you have to do it the opposite way. You mm-hmm. have to start with a clear vision of what it is that both sides will get. And then, because of that, let the moderates in the Palestinian world and the moderates in the Israeli world use that vision as the basis for encouraging people to stop violence against each other. Without that vision, you're asking Palestinians, for example, to wait for 3 years, and then at the end of 3 years, what are they going to get? Well, it's not clear they're going to get anything.
Well, Rabbi, that's certainly a brave and creative and visionary plan on your part, and I'd like to recognize that. How many organizations are signed up to attend this conference, and tell us a little bit about the nature of them?
Well, we have 500 people coming, and we have about 140 meetings with congressmen and senators set up, individual meetings, and we have maybe 15 different organizations that have co-sponsored this. That
are they powerful, influential organizations that are really a part of the dialogues and the dynamics?
Well, the American Friends Service Committee, Pax Christi, there are Jewish organizations that are Rabbis for Human Rights. But if you're asking me, are we going to change the policy immediately, that depends on whether we can build on the local level. We're building this Tikkun community in every community around the country, and we're asking every one of your listeners to go to our website, www.tikkun.org, T-I-K-K-U-N, tikkun.org, and to sign the resolution for Middle East peace. And we're going to be asking not only congressional people, but city councils and elected officials and local churches and mosques and synagogues to endorse this resolution for Middle East peace, because we intend to bring this to the conventions of the major parties in the year 2004 and make this an issue in the election.
Any final thoughts on your part, Rabbi?
Just that I'd like to say that there are millions of people in this country who believe that the Palestinian people and the Israeli people have a right to live in peace side by side with each other. But many of them are afraid to critique Ariel Sharon because they have been told that doing so is, if they're Jewish, they're a self-hating Jew, or if they're non-Jewish, that they are an anti-Semite. And what we're saying is, anybody who accepts the validity of the national self-determination of the Jewish people and allows for our right to national self-determination in our ancient homeland is not an anti-Semite, as well as the rights of the Palestinian people. If for those who want to wipe out Israel, we're not open to that. We don't support that, and we don't want to provide space for that. But for anybody who accepts the right of both of these peoples to national self-determination in Palestine, we want to tell them that the way to help at this point is to come out of the closet and start speaking out about this issue and not allow AIPAC or others to define as anti-Semitic any criticism of the state of Israel, and to say that any criticism of Ariel Sharon's policies is anti-Semitic. But on the other hand, we don't want to support those who are going to come out of the closet and say that the Jews don't have any rights to our own national self-determination.
Rabbi Michael Lerner, peace activist, editor of the Tikkun magazine, and author of Healing Israel-Palestine, A Path to Peace and Reconciliation. As the occupation of Iraq continues its second month and the Pentagon sets its sights on Iran and other so-called rogue nations, we're going to listen to the words of U.S. Marine Officer Schmedley Butler. Butler served in the Marine Corps in the early 1900s, earning 2 Congressional Medals of Honor. He's become something of a Marine Corps legend, not only for his personal courage, but for the energy he put into avoiding bloodshed when it was possible to achieve his aims in other ways. We present now New York activist poet Chris Brandt doing a reading of Butler's infamous speech entitled, War is a Racket.
War is a racket. It always has been. It is possibly the oldest, easily the most profitable, surely the most vicious. It is the only one international in scope. It is the only one in which the profits are reckoned in dollars and the losses in lives. A racket is best described, I believe, as something that is not what it seems to the majority of the people. Only a small inside group knows what it is about. It is conducted for the benefit of the very few, at the expense of the very many. Out of war, a few people make huge fortunes. In the World War, a mere handful garnered the profits of the conflict. At least 21,000 new millionaires and billionaires were made in the United States during the World War. That many admitted their huge blood gains in their income tax returns. How many other war millionaires falsified their tax returns, no one knows. How many of these war millionaires shouldered a rifle? How many of them dug a trench? How many of them knew what it meant to go hungry in a rat-infested dugout? How many of them spent sleepless, frightened nights ducking shells and shrapnel and machine gun bullets? How many of them parried a bayonet thrust of an enemy? How many of them were wounded or killed in battle? Out of war, nations acquire additional territory if they are victorious. They just take it. This newly acquired territory promptly is exploited by the few, the self-same few, who wrung dollars out of blood in the war. The general public shoulders the bill. And what is this bill? This bill renders a horrible accounting. Newly placed gravestones, mangled bodies, shattered minds, broken hearts and homes, economic instability, depression and all its attendant miseries, backbreaking taxation for generations and generations. For a great many years as a soldier, I had a suspicion that war was a racket. Not until I retired to civil life did I fully realize it. Now that I see the international war clouds gathering as they are today, I must face it and speak out.
New York activist poet Chris Brandt doing a reading of Schmedley Butler's infamous speech entitled War is a Racket. Pacifica's Peace Watch is produced in Washington, D.C. Our producer is Scott Gurian. Our editor is Lona Elias. Our engineer is Granger Helvey. Our associate producer is Angelique Shofar. We had production assistance from Jim Bennett and Otto Hammond of KPFA, Bentha Berklin, Aaron Glantz, Pete Weiss, Reem Kathuda, and T from the Pattersons taking the train to Tibet. Thanks to Pete Caracas, Radio for All.net, and Shane Rock at webactive.com for web help. Special thanks also to our consulting producers, Matt Bradley and Sam Husseini. Copies of this program can be ordered from the Pacifica Radio Archives by visiting their websites at pacificaarchives.org or by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to support Peace Watch, we urge you to make a pledge through our secure online website at pacifica.org. Or you can send your donations to Pacifica Radio, 2390 Champlain Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., 20009. We'd love to hear your thoughts on the show. You can send your feedback to us at peacewatch@pacifica.org. You can also visit webactive.com to listen to archives of past Peace Watch programs. I'm Verna Avery Brown, the executive producer. Thank you for listening.